This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Future We Deserve, Learning Hope from Science Fiction.
Now, this week has sort of been inspired by the fact that Jules finally got her wish. and that was for me to watch Star Trek.
Honestly, if I had my way, I'd have you watch so many science fiction programs. But yeah, you've been doing it for a while, in fairness.
I have. I've been watching Next Generation. And I really do enjoy it. And this, as anyone who's ever listened to this podcast before will know, I'm not a big fan of sci-fi, but I do like Star Trek. And Jules and I started to talk about why that was and what the difference was, and that's kind of given birth to this episode a little bit.
Yeah, so, well, we'll do a little recap before we get going, but we'll mostly be drawing on examples from Star Trek because it exemplifies what we want to talk about today so perfectly. So unless it's relevant to the topic of sort of hope and a good future as depicted in science fiction, we probably won't be drawing on other science fiction greats. And that doesn't mean that I at least don't love them. It just means that they're not really relevant to this tiny little segment of science fiction we're talking about. So basically, why science fiction in the first place? Why would that be the place where you go to look for hope? And weirdly, it's for the very reason that it's also the place you go to look for really, really bleak stuff. So it's for the same reason. And that's because science fiction almost all hinges on quite complicated thought experiments. And at its bleakest, I think those thought experiments are taken purely on logic, removing emotional reason. And if that doesn't sound like an oxymoron, it isn't really, if you think about it. There is emotional intelligence and emotional reason as well. Once you remove that from the equation and you're left with pure logic, then yes, the future is very bleak indeed, or it certainly can be, depending on the selection pressures at the time.
Yeah.
But if you allow emotional reason to stay and yet still govern everything with logic, you can get this sort of almost utopian ideal, which still struggles with conflicts and other issues and fight, you know, jostling for a position in the universe, which is what happens in Star Trek. And yet it's still dealing with those same thought experiments. And so anyway, we'll get into that a little bit later, but that is why particularly I think science fiction has such a hold in general.
Yeah.
Now, for me personally, I kind of go to science fiction when, this will sound weird, there's lots of intelligent fantasy out there that makes you think as well, but I think it's when I actually actively want to engage with the sort of thought experiments that you see in science fiction. I've mentioned before, I'm a massive fan of Frank Herbert's Dune, for example, which is almost entirely about both economics and ecology and politics. But I prefer to apparently engage with that in a science fiction setting. So that's clearly on me. For Madeleine, who I won't speak for, perhaps you'd like to weigh in why science fiction works or doesn't work for you.
I think ultimately science fiction, as you've said, Jules, is really a discussion of the human nature and human morality and humanity in a lot of ways, which is amusing because science fiction often incorporates elements which are completely non-human in order to examine what being a human actually is. And oddly enough, sci-fi is used to explore the current, the here and now. Now, that's the same for most speculative fiction in some form or another, but sci-fi is doing it usually very consciously. Science fiction is also different from fantasy because it has a little bit more gravitas in the sense that it presents itself as being potentially true, a potential future that could actually exist, even if it exists in a separate universe entirely. It's based on ideas and fears and worries and projections of our current modern day. That's why sci-fi for me can be so both so frightening but also quite inspiring in a lot of ways. Now, unfortunately, I'm not a big sci-fi fan, and actually that tends to be because I'm pretty terrified of the concept of space. I'm not really keen on it, to be honest. It's just death. I kind of take a bit of a Bones approach when it comes to that. A Dr. McCoy, we're speeding through a vacuum of death kind of approach towards it. I'm also not really kind of into the general sort of narratives. I find them bleak often, and I also miss out on some of the things that I absolutely adore, which is world building. But world building which is based on cultures that feel ancient and mystical and a little bit magical. And often sci-fi for me tries to kind of remove that element of mysticism and just put everything to science and say everything's explained, this is why this is happening. And it all feels too set in stone, too logical. And the big problem for me is when they basically say, this is how it works, and then explain all of this jargon, which is very scientific, which for some people is brilliant, because they're like, yeah, fantastic. I almost feel like it could be real. Whereas for me, it just distances me. I find the narrative style too thick, too intense. It doesn't engage me. And to be honest, I'm more likely to feel like Harry Potter is realistic than some sci-fi in general. It also quite often just depresses me, to be honest. There's a lot of very bleak sci-fi out there, which I find incredibly depressing and that I don't really want to touch. But it is why that occasionally there is some sci-fi that I just cannot get enough of. And weirdly enough, it tends to be sci-fi which is mixed in with other things instead, and therefore has kind of broken that intensity while still maintaining some of the integral things which are very admirable about sci-fi as a genre.
Yeah, definitely. Right, well, today obviously we're not looking at the bleak stuff. We're going to accidentally touch on the bleak stuff because we will look at some of the most common thought experiments that sci-fi looks at.
Mm-hmm.
And generally in other programs and other books and things, they tend to get taken to, as Madeline says, a very bleak place. Star Trek doesn't do that, so we're mostly going through Star Trek and looking at it, hopefully. One of the things I will say about Star Trek from the get-go, and I think this is true across all of the different spin-off series and the original series, and, you know, the films to a certain extent before everything up to Discovery, which I will touch later, carefully, is the fact that generally you start from a position of inclusiveness. So you start from a position where you have a tight-knit group of people. They don't all like each other, they don't all get on along, and they don't necessarily all understand each other culturally. But everyone starts from a position of, yes, that person deserves mutual respect. Yeah. And attention. So they start from the position of something weird happens and, you know, the person it happens to expects to be believed. I can't stress how rare that is. I mean, it can be something as simple as, okay, three books went missing from the library where I work, and at that time they just disappeared completely. They were brand new books, they disappeared off the new book stand. And I brought it up and I said, look, we've looked everywhere for them. They've just, they're gone. They've gone missing. And I said, I don't want to say that I think someone's walked off with them and stolen them, but I think that may possibly be what's happened, because they're just, you know, kaputs, gone.
Yeah.
And the person who I was referring this to at the time was kind of like, I think you need to go back and look again. And in even that, it was a case of, I felt comfortable bringing up the issue, but the person didn't necessarily believe me that I'd looked as well as I could.
Yeah.
And that's just a tiny thing. Can you imagine going to your boss about something big? Can you imagine going to your boss about, say, oh, this other colleague tried to sexually assault me? And perhaps you're a less valuable member of staff, and therefore your boss doesn't believe you, because they can afford to lose you, but they can't afford to lose the other person. This is also a situation I've had. So the fact that Star Trek starts from the position of, wow, something really weird and inexplicable has happened to me, I guess I'm just going to bring it up with my superior. And it's like, okay, well, that sounds highly improbable, but you know what? Let's raise it to the captain and make him aware of it, or her aware of it too. And it's just, as I said, I can't stress how strange and wonderful that is.
There's this, I want to give an example of this that actually does happen in Star Trek, which, because I was literally thinking about this whilst watching this episode yesterday. And it's one where Worf is returning from a fighting competition. And he keeps, every now and again, he suddenly finds that things around him are changing. So it starts off very small. There's a surprise birthday party waiting for him when he gets back. And initially the cake is chocolate, and then he looks again and it's a sponge cake instead. And then someone says, oh, Captain Picard is occupied on the bridge, he can't make it. And then the next thing they know, the captain is there. And these things get gradually bigger and bigger, and the changes become much larger, till the point that suddenly Worf has a wife and two children that he didn't have before. Incredibly awkward. He's lost his other child, his son Alexander, doesn't exist anymore. Geordi is dead. Geordi gets killed. And then at one point he's just suddenly finds himself standing at a console, unable to raise the shields around the ship whilst they're being attacked. And as a consequence of this, this is how Geordi dies, because they can't raise the shield, so the ship is attacked and Geordi receives massive burns from it and dies. So this is a very serious situation. This is no longer the chocolate cake is different, okay? This is a people have literally died situation. And Worf turns around and basically says, look, there is something weird happening. I remember things completely differently, and yet the world around me is changing. Now, automatically, usually, if you came up and said that to someone, they'd be like, you may be crazy. And initially they do say, well, you did have a concussion, so maybe it's the memory loss. But once, when Worf insists that no, something is weird, they start to explore why that might be. And initially they just come up with absolutely nothing. Now, I was watching this just expecting them at every turn to say, look, there's nothing. But instead, they continue to be really helpful, like, okay, let's try and get to the bottom of this, until they actually find out that Worf has been jumping through several different reality dimensions.
Yeah.
And it ends with like a trillion Enterprises just all ending up in the same dimensional space because of a rift or whatever. I can't remember the science behind it. And he does manage to get back to his own reality. And I did really, really like that, because there is no way in pretty much any other sci-fi narrative, pretty much in any other kind of narrative, where a story that crazy would actually be believed enough to be continually tested until they found a result. In every other narrative, there would be a very sort of, no, you're crazy, and this person would have to prove it for themselves, and then there would be a, oh god, you were right and we were wrong, and because of that there's been X, Y, and Z. And instead, they were just helpful and understanding, And I think the other amazing thing about it was that that didn't make the episode any less interesting either. There was still a great level of drama, there was still a lot of tension, but it wasn't created within the group. There is tension between characters sometimes in Star Trek, you know, particularly original Star Trek, between Spock and Bones, but there is this sense of great unity, which I just think is kind of amazing.
Yeah, and I think the thing that you'd think, wouldn't you, that if you had someone who had this conflict within their arc, for whatever the weekly feature of that episode is, whoever's the main character, had that sort of conflict with reality, and their perception of reality was different, you would think there would be less tension in the arc of the entire episode than it, you know, by them being believed and accepted from the get-go, than there would if people kept sort of almost gaslighting them into doubting whether their feelings were valid or not. Instead, the position is, you know what, I don't perceive reality like that, but I believe that you do. Let's find out why. And it works, because what it does is it frees up the narrative to really explore things like multiverse theory. So as you say, there is high level of drama. It's still just as compelling as it would be if it was a case of, oh God, I'm doubting my own memories. And yeah, quite frankly, there's only so many times you can tell the, oh, this weird thing's happened, I'm doubting my own perception of reality story. Yeah. Without it getting incredibly boring.
Yeah, and also with the whole you're crazy, we're going to lock you up kind of thing. And I think also that I really enjoyed it because, as I said, they were actually able to explore a very different dynamic, which is that Worf's wife, I'm not going to say who it is, believes him when he says, you're not actually my wife, there's something weird going on. And instead you have this drama about the fact that she knows she's about to lose her husband, or that he is a virgin who never loved her instead. And she doesn't try and force him to, she's just incredibly sad, and she's incredibly sad that, you know, they've got these two children who suddenly appear. It is quite funny, he says, what about our children? And Worf just like, what? We have children? Because 20 minutes ago we did not have children, and he realises that he's just jumped into another dimension again. And I really, really liked that, because that's quite, not an unusual narrative, but it's not an overly used one instead. And we got to focus on something different.
Yeah.
I think ultimately, though, the thing that makes Star Trek hopeful for me isn't just the fact that everybody tries to be, you know, understanding and to respect one another. It's that there is also a great understanding that different things work for different people. Now, Worf is a Klingon, okay? He has a very specific kind of custom and culture, which could very easily have been played off as just completely barbaric. He could just be continuously a character who's used and disrespected for his violent kind of means or anything like that. Data is a character who is an android. He could just be used to always be clinical and cold and calculating. Those things would have been very, very possible. And they might have been what you'd expect. But instead, there's this humongous respect for the Klingon culture throughout the ship. Like, they all engage with it in different ways, and they all understand it, or not understand it. Sometimes they don't understand it, but they choose to respect it anyway. They help Worf go through certain rituals. Whereas you have Data, who has no real sense of, you know, original culture, and that he's the first of his kind. He's not actually the first of his kind. I'm going to say the only android. He isn't. But let's just say he's very alone in the universe, okay? He doesn't have a culture, he doesn't have a history or anything like that. And rather than being the cold, calculating character, he embroils himself in culture in order to be human. So he's very artistic. He makes an effort to do that. And he's actually one of the kindest characters. And he's very thoughtful and considerate. And I love that. I really, really like the fact that there's just this general kind of optimism, which is that everyone is doing their absolute best. No one is just a base, single, one-dimensional level of human or non-human, of entity. They're all kind of striving to be better in terms of bettering themselves or respecting the cultures and differences of other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Data's a really good example because, as you say, he's kind of devoid of culture.
He is.
He's the only one of his kind in a lot of ways. And he's kind of a tin man in the sense of, well, I don't have a heart. I don't have these instinctively programmed mammalian emotions. Therefore, I must try this much harder in order to try and emulate the behaviour because that's the acceptable standard of behaviour.
Yeah.
And he's attempting to learn at the same time. You know, he's programmed to learn and acquire information to become more human in his interactions. And it's a fascinating way of doing it because, as you say, they could have gone either the comedic Star Wars droids route or they could have gone down the cold analytical, I don't see the point of humans, let's destroy everything else in the universe route, which many sci-fi universes actually do.
Yeah. I quite like the fact that also Data is a great parallel of Spock, because Spock is obviously half human, and he's kind of striving to be what Data is, which is completely logical, very effective. Whereas Data, who has reached that, what even Spock himself says Vulcans would consider perfection, is trying to go the other way. And it's really nice because they both occupy the space of being the logical character on the main deck, and yet they are completely contrasting characters. Data is very human in a lot of ways, and he's also quite a comedic character too. I mean, Brent Spiner is a very funny actor, so he's got great physical comedy, great timing. But I think there's nothing funnier than the first few episodes where Data is trying to emulate kind of like human behavior but still hasn't quite got the hang of it. So everyone laughs and then he just laughs a little bit delayed and it's really unnatural, like ha 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 ha, and continues on with his conversation. And the doctor says, oh, and when you're dancing, just try to smile. And you see him practicing dancing, and as he turns around, he's got this grin on his face, which is really disconcerting.
Yeah, it's great. It's really well done.
Yeah, he's an incredibly funny character.
Yeah, but he's not just played for laughs either, is he? There's something quite poignant about the whole situation. And the further you go in and the more he learns, and how far have you got?
I'm towards on season the end. 7. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I won't say anything. But look, just like all I will say is just grasp the future with your fingernails because Picard is coming, okay? So the new series of Picard is coming. It looks like it might be really, really good.
I know, that's why I'm trying to watch as much as possible.
Yeah, and it's not to say that Star Trek shies away from, as we've said, the thought exercises of the problems that sci-fi attempts to engage with. So, for example, if you were to take something like have you heard of the light bulb? I was going to say the light bulb. I don't mean light bulb. I mean lifeboat problem.
Remind me?
Okay, basically, you're in an apocalyptic situation, or if you like, you're on the Titanic and you have a lifeboat. There's one lifeboat left. There's a group of you. Not all of you are going to fit in the lifeboat. So it's a case of deciding who is worthy to survive.
Right, yes.
And if you were to make it based entirely on who can actually contribute the most, you would pick adults who are already grown and but still had the potential to procreate, who were intelligent, who were physically very fit. And what this does is it shunts aside everybody who is already marginalized in society. So if you were being very bleak and very cold, then it makes a certain logical sense. But the problem is it divorces the entire situation of emotional reason, as I've said. Mm-hmm. And as a little aside, if we were going to say, okay, well, we're only going, it's not a very big leap, for example, to go from someone physically fit, intelligent, and able to procreate to, oh God, we've got too many of those as well. We need to narrow it down even further. So these people, we want the absolute best. Let's divide them down the lines of morality, very upstanding people, which means that in this hypothetical scenario, you might have a physically fit on the outside woman who was already pregnant, who just hadn't had the best start in life and had been working as a prostitute. And what you're doing in that situation is you're basically saying that Beethoven can't get on the lifeboat because Beethoven's mother was a prostitute. He had syphilis, which he contracted in the womb from his mother because of the lifestyle she'd had to lead. Yeah. And yet he's one of the greatest musical geniuses of all time. So who gets to weigh these things up? And even if he wasn't all of those things, who actually has the right to say whether that woman deserved to get on the lifeboat or not? You know?
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. So yes, from a logical point of view, it's a case of, okay, the human race depends on this, then you pick those who are able, etc. But on the other side, it's a case of, no, this is a really, really bad thing to keep emphasizing in science fiction, because what you're saying is that these people actually aren't worth anything even when times are good, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it does also, it's very interesting for me, and again, something I really like about Star Trek is the way that it sort of looks at this as well, in that there's a lot of emphasis which is put on what do we need in order to survive, who's going to be best in helping us to survive. And a lot of people kind of put things on, okay, are they physically fit? You have all the sci-fi, it's like, yeah, they're good at guns, I'm good at guns, I'm a survivor, I could be a warrior. Completely ignoring the very practical things that people need in order to survive, which is the ability to cultivate food, the ability to make clothes, okay, the ability to make shelter. And once you've got all of those things, actually the ability to keep up morale is incredibly important.
Yeah, to create social harmony so that you do actually get along long enough to survive.
Yeah. And again, I think that there's this, weirdly enough, in a culture which is all about telling stories, in the fact that these are stories being told which disregard the importance of the storyteller, which for me is kind of mind-boggling, in that we kind of put the creative arts to the side and we say they're not useful, misunderstanding actually what their use actually is, not just in terms of entertainment, but in terms of identity, in terms of morale, but also the fact that in every single culture, these things appear, not because they just do, but because they are actually necessary, because we need them. That is why we continuously create them. Now, again, in a logical standpoint, if it's between me, someone who can weave a story, and someone else who happens to have an incredibly useful skill which will help people survive, you would choose the person that would help people survive. I kind of understand that. And yet, it's tends to be an incredible situation whereby those are the only options. And why are they the only options? Why are we continually told those are the only options? Throughout history, how often have we actually found that to be the case? We look at the Titanic. Who did they save? Was it a decision of, if we all die on the Titanic, the human race will stop? No. So we don't actually really have that many examples in history where something so disastrous has happened that the resources have been so limited that we've actually had to decide who's going to survive and who isn't. Because when those kinds of things happen, it does tend to be done on sentimentality. People say, I will protect my family instead, rather than we will pick and choose. There are very few cases. In fact, I can't think of any cases, I'm sure there are, of examples where it is, right, humanity,
we as a people need to survive, so we're going to pick and choose how that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, we are obviously wired to protect our own tribe first and then our own smaller tribe, which is our family or whatever. And that, you know, that's sort of understandable. But once you get beyond that, as you say, we don't really have that many examples of this complete total disaster scenario, which is obviously why sci-fi likes to engage with the thought problem. But on the other hand, there's a logical fallacy around all thought problems or all thought experiments. I mean, just look at Plato's Republic, for example, the idea that you could create a utopian society if what you first did was you marched on a city and took it over and you murdered everybody under the age of 10 and then you raised those children how you wanted them to, in a species of sort of equality, etc.
Sorry, do you mean murdered everyone over the age of 10?
Over the age of 10. Did I say under? Okay. Everyone over the age of 10, you get rid of them all, you know, complete blanket sweep. And then you raise those children to be the next citizens. So you're not even taking the city for yourself. You're basically raising a nation whereby everyone treats themselves equally. And it's an interesting thought experiment, like thought experiments are supposed to be, but it's also completely and utterly nuts, you know? And I will deviate from Star Trek very slightly here to talk about Joe Walton's excellent series, the first book of which is called The Just City, mm-hmm. which is something that Plato refers to. And it's basically a case of a bunch of the Greek gods kind of get together and say, you know, the human race isn't really working. And Athena's kind of like, well, I think Plato was onto something when he was talking about the just city. So what they do is they go through time and they select all the best people they possibly can at the moment of their death and save them and take them off to the just city with the idea that they will be the teachers of the future generation. And then they think, well, shit, we need to get some children under the age of 10. And what they actually do is they create a slave trade without meaning to, because they need children under the age of 10. They think, well, the best thing to do is buy up these slave children because, you know, they were going to be enslaved anyway. This will be so much better. And the slavers are like, wow, the slave children, they'll pay anything for them. You know, let's enslave more children. And therefore, so they start this highly questionable moral problem where they've created, like, a supply and demand issue in children, and that's before they even get the just city going. So and it doesn't really work in a lot of ways. It's interesting, and I love how Jo Walton's done it, and she's kind of gently mocked the entire thing. And she's right, in my opinion, she is right. But I think this very sort of headache creating issue is probably part of why you don't actually enjoy a lot of sci-fi, because a lot of it goes there, and if you don't really like that and you just think, well, this is ridiculous, then it's perfectly understandable that you wouldn't enjoy it.
I find it just brings out my anxiety. I'm not gonna lie.
No, that's absolutely
I do not want
fine.
To deal with these situations when I don't actually have to deal with them. Now, Sometimes I do like kind of engaging with these philosophical questions, and I think that there's nothing wrong with that, and there's nothing wrong with sci-fi continually, you know, asking these questions and engaging with them. Because as human beings, that's kind of what we do. We anticipate problems, we're problem solvers, and so we like to kind of plan ahead. We think about things, and that makes sense. It also makes sense that we would engage with problems which were even bigger, and we would find entertainment in that. I mean, just think about how we entertain ourselves in general. We, you know, puzzles and video games, Sudoku, crosswords, things like that. We do like to be challenged. So it makes sense that we would have these challenges in the narratives, in these discussions of these episodes. At the same time, however, I do think that it's a bit of a tired question, this lifeboat question, and I think that it also, in continuously using it, particularly in sci-fi, which is meant to project our future, we are, as you've said, insisting on this narrative that this isn't just something we need to think about. This is a reality. This is where we're headed. This is the decision that we are going to have to face as human beings. And as you say, it reiterates this idea that there are some people who are more valuable in society than others. And it isn't just in case of what skills do you have, it's or what job you have to be. It usually actually targets people who are disabled, for instance. You're not intelligent enough. You're not physically capable enough. You cannot provide anything for society. Therefore, because you don't offer anything, you are not, you hold less value, which is frankly dangerous. And by repeatedly asking this question of who would we choose in this situation, we're kind of actually ignoring the question of how do we avoid this situation? Or actually, would the situation even happen? So there's nothing wrong with asking the question, but continuously asking it and not engaging in really many other kind of narratives at all, I find it boring and dangerous. And we should stop using it as a projection and remember that it is just a philosophical question.
Yeah, definitely. And this is another thing where, back on Star Trek, where Star Trek does it completely differently. If you look at Earth in Star Trek, suddenly nobody's actually had to sacrifice their culture. Everybody still has their distinct culture, their distinct origins, but Earth is run as like a single unit. You have a single governing council that looks after the concerns of Earth. The whole point being that they had a brief, very sort of slight dystopian period, and then when we discovered that we were not alone in the universe, it changed everybody's attitudes. And then suddenly what you had was, you have shared resources and wealth, you have mutual respect and understanding, or attempted understanding for each other. That's not to say there aren't small conflicts, there are, but nobody's going to war with each other anymore. We're a unified unit on Earth. There's tolerance. I can't stress how important that one is. And there's no money. Everybody is given what they need to survive. And if you want, you know, people are called to jobs that they feel very strongly about doing. And there's a lot of theorizing about the fact that if everybody was given a universal basic income, it wouldn't result in lots of lazy people sitting around doing sod all. What it would actually mean was that with no stress to provide the basic necessities of life, food, shelter, gas, electricity, what have you, clothing, once you've got your basic needs taken care of, people would actually start focusing on doing work that either they enjoyed or they felt compelled to do because they could do it well. So not everybody then needs to be an intellectual giant or a great artist. Some people could just feel a sense of pride and achievement in serving. And that's not, I don't mean this in any sense of a communist type way. It's not a case of, oh, we are all cogs in the machine, comrade, kind of thing. It's not like that at all. But it's this idea of once you're free to do anything, you're suddenly capable of well, once you're free to do anything, you're capable of anything.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't feel called to be a surgeon or, you know, a rocket scientist. Maybe you're just somebody who is happy to do the refuse collection and the recycling and everything, but you know that your contribution is just as important. So that's a thought experiment I can actually get behind, and I would like to see that properly tested. I know they are testing it in certain sub-Saharan African villages. With some very interesting results. But they've already got that as sort of ground zero for Earth in Star Trek. And I love that because that explains where this attitude on board your starship comes from. This idea of, you know what you say will be believed and we will trust you, and you're going to fail and we will trust you again, and you might fail again and we will keep trusting you because we think that your attitude of suspicion and being annoyed and pushing people away has come from the fact that you've been raised in a place that hasn't valued you as an individual, hasn't valued you for what you are. And this is particularly apparent with the character of Garak in Deep Space Nine. Garak is a part of a shadowy organization who is, and he's a spy, and he's had to do some very dark shit. And he's set up on Deep Space Nine as basically a tailor. He makes clothes. He's pretty good at it as well. But he's still kind of got his ear to the ground. And he fucks up a lot. He falls and fails a lot. And he sneers at people and he pushes them away. And they keep saying, well, you know, we're not going to massively give you huge chunks of responsibility, but we kind of claim you as ours, and we're going to keep showing you that we trust you until you prove you're worthy of it, because we know you can be. And it's such an interesting way of addressing that particular character issue. And it works in the end. It's a slow battle, but it works.
Yeah. I've not watched Deep Space Nine, so I can't comment on that.
Yeah, so the attitude behind it, the idea of expect yeah. people to raise to rise to your expectations. So if you believe people will do good, then you might actually make them surprise themselves.
I think another thing that I really like about Star Trek, which kind of is similar to that, is the way that they look at technology. Now, technology is always going wrong in Star Trek. You know, they continuously have little blips and problems and things like that.
It's like the holodeck. Why? Why do you keep using the holodeck? You know something's going to go horribly wrong. Or there's going to be a transporter accident and two of you are going to get splinched together and it'll be two people who really don't like each other.
But the reason I like it, and again, it falls into that idea that actually, you know, a universal kind of income, everyone gets the same and they just do the jobs that they want to do. I think it's great. Because actually, you know, people say, oh, but, you know, what about all these unpleasant jobs that nobody would want to do? You have technology. The technology does those kinds of unpleasant jobs. And it makes me think about, you know, our Industrial Revolution, where everyone hated machinery because suddenly they were taking the jobs of the people, of people, and people no longer had work to do things. But suddenly, if you don't need to work in order to survive, then you don't need the job that a machine can do probably more efficiently than you can. And there's now jobs open to maintain those machines, which lots of people would actually quite probably enjoy doing because they like tinkering, they like changing things. There's jobs open to be creative and to create things without having to worry about whether you can support yourself with that. And I really, really kind of like that environment, this positivity about machinery and about technology, when usually a lot of sci-fi is based on fear-mongering of what if machines do gain sentience. So you have that question, what if a machine do gain sentience? In Data. Now, Data does have a brother, Lore, who is kind of evil. And yet, weirdly enough, Lore has emotions and Data doesn't. And Lore's emotions are kind of what makes him crazy.
Yeah, Lore was the prototype, and they actually built him too well, to the point where his creators were very nervous of him, at least.
Yeah, and within reason, you know, he murdered quite a few people. whereas Data, who should be the emotionless, you know, the Vault, the Ultron, basically, of the world, is not. He doesn't have human emotions. And he's actually a very good person. And despite the fact that he doesn't have human emotions, I maintain that he does have emotions. They just work in a different way. He's very, very human. He's very compassionate. He has a lot of kindness. They just function in a different way. After all, what is emotion and kindness and things like that except chemicals in our brain? Why is it any different for him just because they're, you know, they're subroutines or whatever in a, you know, down wires instead?
Yeah,
regardless,
ultimately he makes choices, doesn't he? He chooses, instead of going, well, actually I can calculate things about 6,000 times faster than the rest of you, which is no exaggeration, therefore I think I'll make myself master of everything. But he doesn't. He makes choices to, actually, I want to engage with these people. I want to become part of this family, basically.
Yeah. And also the choices he makes aren't necessarily logical. He just does them because he decides that those are the right things to do. For instance, you see at one point one of the characters kind of faints, and Data will step up and grab them. Now,
he's not gaining anything by grabbing them. They're not likely really to hurt themselves if they fall over. It's not really his duty. But he does. He'll steady someone as well.
Yeah.
That's a tiny choice that makes him very, very human.
Yeah, definitely. Another thing that's worth mentioning, and we're particularly looking at Next Generation at the moment, but yeah. Obviously, how many other groups of explorers, if you like, because that is how, you know, the Starfleet build their explorers, they're seeking to learn and understand about the universe and, you know, to engage with people who meet the first contact protocols. We won't go into all of all those bits and pieces because we just don't have time. But how many other ships like that would you have a senior member of staff who is a mental health care professional?
Not many.
I can't think of any other examples right now. And I know she becomes Commander Troi. I know Counselor Troi actually does come in for a lot of mockery from a lot of people, but I really feel that the point has gone so far over those people's heads, because what they're saying there is, yes, we're living in a fabulous future where, you know, everybody's treated equally and there's tolerance and acceptance for everyone and you will be believed. But we're also saying that part of the price of that is understanding that everybody's mental health is valuable as well, that you're not just handing down a set of orders and expecting people to get on with it. And, you know, there are times when the chain of command has to be pulled. But at the same time, let's not all pretend that everybody isn't as valuable as everybody else. And I think, you know, it's taken the whole lifeboat problem and tipped it completely over. So that nobody is more valuable than anybody else. They're all valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, it also perpetrates this idea of, you have Captain Picard and you have Will Riker. They're both, you know, strapping men, you know. they're both quite physical. Captain Picard is also highly intellectual. Will is not exactly stupid either. They're all very artistic too. Will is a musician. Captain Picard also plays music and is very engaged in the arts as well. It's not one or the other. You know, Dr. Crusher is a dancer. Data paints and plays music as well. In fact, they all pretty much engage in some form of art. And the thing I like best about it is that you've got Captain Picard, who not only is this, you know, very, is a man of action, you know, and he's definitely a man, you know, he's a manly man in a lot of ways. He's a giant nerd. And what does he do in his free time? He goes to the holodeck and he acts out and he basically role plays as a detective. Okay?
Yeah.
and not only does he do that, he invites other people to join him as well on his crew. Like, he's not ashamed of it. He has a lot of fun. Data pretends to be Sherlock Holmes. They all engage in theatre as well. They really, really enjoy themselves constantly with this. And it's not unabashed. And this is another thing I wanted to mention in terms of the technology. You do have this technology which can create these amazing physical illusions, right? And, you know, that could be constantly used, you know, in order to create camouflage and things like that. That's how they could have used that. But instead, actually, the Federation have said, we will not hook up ships. They've written a treaty which means that they are not allowed to cloak their ships at all, which puts them at a heavy disadvantage against the Romulans and the Klingons at times, okay? But the Federation will not cloak their ships at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the party line is that they're explorers, they're not warrior class ships at all.
Exactly. So they have this technology.
If you want to get really nerdy into the background, where I start to get a bit sort of like, well, I don't think Curzon Dax actually negotiated the Kitimar Accords as well as everybody says he did, because of the whole cloaking technology thing. But yeah, the whole point is, we're not there hidden, we're there openly. We're here to engage and learn. We are not here. We come in peace. We literally come in peace, you know.
So they have this amazing technology. And what do they use it for? They use it to entertain themselves, to tell stories. Sometimes they use it for therapeutic reasons, sometimes they use it for scientific reasons. But the holodecks are available regardless of what you're doing, whether it's recreational, whether it is creative, whether it is a form of therapy, which some of them do use it for, or whether actually in some cases they're trying to figure out a problem. They use it regardless. And I think that's kind of amazing, actually, that there is this amazing piece of technology which is used for creative and recreational pursuits unabashedly.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to move us on a little bit because I thought this discussion would be kind of like, yeah, we'll get through it quite quickly. But actually, I've just realised how much material we have. We might have to do a follow-up episode at some point. But let's talk about conflict. Now, when Gene Roddenberry wrote the original Star Trek series, I'm not going to say there weren't clunky bits, there really were. But he was literally going where no man had gone before at that point in writing it. Because sci-fi before that point was very pulpy. It was very black and white in terms of morality. It was brave Earth man, and it always was a man. And the beautiful but somewhat dim damsel that he might like help, or might have a very, very minor role helping him as his sidekick, goes up against the evil and surprisingly reminiscent of the culture of the time that they did not like, villain. And the Star Trek completely wiped all that away. And one of the things Gene Roddenberry said was he did not want there to be nasty ongoing conflicts between characters on the ship.
Yeah.
And that is something that modern sci-fi writers, some of them have kind of tripped over, because again, I think the point has kind of gone over their heads. The thing is, if you take take the Enterprise, for example, there are minor conflicts within the characters in the original series. Obviously Bones and Spock, or rather Bones kind of doesn't like Spock. In fact, you might say that Bones' attitude to Spock is a little bit racist.
Yes.
So there is and he learns better later on. So, well, he starts calling him, "Oh, you green-blooded bastard," or whatever. And then later on when he says it, it's said without any rancour, it's said without suspicion. They have become a unit, a family. He's actually carried Spock's katra at that point. He's carried Spock's soul. So he might still call him, "Oh, you green-blooded bastard," but it's kind of like, I've learned to love you despite myself.
Yeah.
Through proximity. And then you go on to things like The Next Generation, and yeah, there are minor conflicts, but you know what they do? They have conversations about that shit. They talk to each other and work it out.
They do. They're actually very adult about it.
It's kind of like, you're not using a cheap gimmick in order to keep your series going. And I'm not saying that interpersonal conflicts aren't interesting, they really are, and I don't think some of them ever entirely go away, but the characters are allowed to grow. You don't hit a reset button every week in order that you can have Picard still maintain the position where he doesn't really like children very much, or yeah, doesn't understand them, or where Riker is literally just a bit of a, not so much a player, but goes through life very, very lightly. I think his judgment matures quite a bit. And then you have things like Wesley, who's kind of like, honestly, not a character I love greatly, although I did as a child. But again, he's allowed to grow up and learn and leave his mother and make other decisions.
Yeah. Whether they be right or wrong.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I also want to talk about original Star Trek and talk about who was on the crew. And actually, why we look back at old Star Trek and we go, wow, that's, wow, okay. Like, and this week, William Shatner teaches an alien woman how to love. And it's very old fashioned in a lot of ways. But we've also got to look at it and go, hold on a second. Look at the crew. What is the crew made up of? Okay. You have a Southern gentleman, okay, in Bones, representing probably one of the most racist parts of the US, let's not lie.
Yeah.
You have a Southern gentleman, you have an alien, okay, who it's kind of made to look a little bit sort of demonic originally when they kind of, you know, made him, you know, the whole pointy ears thing. I mean, that thing it is, he pointy-eared, green-blooded goblin.
Yeah.
You know, he, kind of a little bit demonic. And then you have an Asian man who is played by a Japanese actor, okay? You have a Russian.
You this have... is in the middle of the Cold War, by
yeah,
the way.
This is in the middle of a Cold War following Japanese concentration camps. You have a black woman as well during all of the, you know, the struggles with Martin Luther King and all of that jazz. Okay. And you have all of them together on the bridge. And none of them have any problems with each other. They all just get on. And this is... Gene Roddenberry wanted to write a narrative about the modern day and about the conflicts to kind of improve it, and he wasn't allowed. So what he did was he projected them into the future, and he brought all these characters forward and basically said, and they're all equal. This is what we're heading towards. This is the right course of action. There is hope. And that's amazing. And one thing you see continuously in the background of the first few seasons of Next Generation is there is a crew member who physically seems to be coded as a man, but who is wearing the female uniform. And not only is he wearing the female uniform, he's wearing a very, very short skirt. And I say he, we don't actually know what gender they are.
Yeah.
But this was a very conscious decision to basically kind of to sort of play on that idea. And in Next Generation as well, at one point, Riker does fall in love with a character who is sort of meant to be non-binary. These characters are not meant to have gender at all, and are not supposed and certainly not meant to be kind of attracted in terms of gender, but the character that he falls in love with identifies as female. And it's an incredibly sad episode, but the Jonathan Frakes, is that what his name is?
Yeah, Jonathan Frakes.
Jonathan Frakes originally wanted the character of Sora, or Sorin, I think their name was, her name was. He wanted Sorin to be played by a male actor. And ultimately, decisions were made for that not to happen. And certainly, I think in the crew, there have been, you know, issues of homophobia. Not in the crew, but in some of the directive decisions, yeah. There have been issues which have been marked by homophobia. But if we look at the original concept of Gene Roddenberry's ideal, it was meant to be one of, this is where we're headed, this is the future.
Yeah.
And look actually how it functions. And look actually how it works. When everyone is treated equal, suddenly everyone becomes equal.
Yeah, and it obviously, well, we're sort of talking about diversity here, and Star Trek was one of the things that first did it. We were talking about I don't want to keep bringing up the lifeboat, but the whole idea that, you know, Geordi LaForge, born blind, and yet
yes.
is, you know, it starts off as an ensign and works his way up and is, again, as equal as everyone else, despite his disability. There are other disabled characters as well. Accommodation is made for different species. And then there's the episode where Dr. Crusher falls in love with a male Trill, not realizing that the Trill are made up of two people. The actual humanoid Trill and the creature inside, which is actually hundreds of years old and sort of works as a symbiotic organism with them. And that episode particularly affected me as a child, because there's an accident and the man she's fallen in love with is injured so badly that his body is beyond repair. So they have to desperately send for another Trill host in order to preserve the parasite inside, or, you know, the symbiotic organism, which sort of looks a bit sort of slug-like. The only host that they can get to them in that amount of time has a female body. So this Trill organism, but you know, the symbiote is implanted into a woman. The actual symbionts don't have like a gender particularly at all. They assume the gender of whoever they are implanted in. still feels exactly the same about Dr. Crusher. And she's like, I still love you too, but I am not attracted to women at all. And it's, as I said, that caused a lot of conflict for me as a child. That was the thing that first started raising questions for me. But yeah, it's a really sad episode. It's a case of, I was sat there at 10 years old thinking, why can't they be together anyway? Why does it make any difference? It shouldn't make any difference, which really should have like told me a few things quite early on in my life, but somehow didn't because of what I was surrounded by. But literally, Star Trek goes places where no one has gone before, and it generally keeps doing it. And this was back when the Next Generation originally aired in the mid to late 80s. So yeah, it's really done the diversity thing, which kind of brings me on to Star Trek Discovery, which I don't think Madeline's watched.
No, I haven't.
No. I'm not going to say don't watch it. The first season is pretty good, and it's set on the Star Trek timeline much earlier than the original series even. Or, you know, just sort of slightly before. So you've got Enterprise, which is the one regarding Captain Archer, and then you've kind of got Discovery, where the humans and the Klingons are properly at war.
Yeah.
And that first season of Discovery follows Michael Burnham, who is played by a black female actress, and absolutely great. I had more problems getting over the fact that Michael could be a female name, and now I'm kind of like, yeah, why not? Why the hell not? And again, once again, the crew is representative of a huge range of diversity. And again, that wasn't an issue. Where it started to get weird was with the storytelling. Now, Star Trek, despite the fact that you could say, oh, well, Captain Picard is the main character, or Sisko is the main character, or Janeway, or whoever, actually, the entire thing does not hinge on the captain or the leader. It hinges on whoever is the main character that week in that episode. And yes, there is an overreaching arc, but you're exploring through various different characters. Discovery doesn't do this. Discovery stays almost exclusively behind Michael Burnham's viewpoint, which sort of worked for the first season because of what was going on and what she had been accused of. But after that, it was a case of, no, this is supposed to be Star Trek. It's claiming it's Star Trek. You are not giving us an ensemble piece. And then it really fucked up in the second season, where someone needed to die and they hadn't introduced this character properly. They'd shown the character on screen, and we were supposed to go, well, that's either an early android or it's a bionic character somehow. They did the entire introduction of that character in that episode, and they killed her in the same episode. And then they had a really lavish, weepy funeral for her. And Alan and I were sat there going, well, like, fuck, are we going to be upset about this? Because we don't care about that character. You've shown her on screen, like, once or twice in the last two seasons. So there was that issue. And then it's the fact that a lot of the diversity in Discovery has become a tick box exercise. And that's not good representation. That's bad representation. Mm-hmm. That's not a case of, we must have our quota of gay or queer or black or any other minority actors and actresses or characters. That doesn't work. Ultimately, the diversity should be effortless, because what you should care about is the character. You should be introduced to the character, and then afterwards you should be kind of going, wow, we're in the middle of the Cold War and they included a Polish character and he's like a fan favourite. You should not be going, okay, I feel like this is being shoved in my face and Star Trek was already diverse. So how it feels to me is if there are far too many people who are concerned not with telling a story, but with being perceived to be diverse and politically incorrect, all trying to write at the same time. And it's a too many cooks situation.
Yeah. So
I don't recommend the second season of Discovery. I think we've got like three episodes left and we just kind of put it down and it's like, this is not engaging us anymore. And it's incredibly frustrating because you think, oh, a new season of Star Trek, you know, will they let them have more than three seasons? Or will they, like, cut you off? and then they just pull this bullshit, and it's just... The other thing is that almost all the conflict is internal between characters in a way that you would never see with any other series of Star Trek. Instead of there being sort of like genuine characters rubbing up against each other in the wrong way, but still finding a way to coexist, there's really nasty conflict. There's sort of like, you know, the fact Michael Burnham is almost shunned by everybody initially. And it's really unpleasant. It's not what you sign on for when you sign on for Star Trek.
No.
And as a minor headcanon thing, the Klingons are just kind of like, yeah, the makeup and everything is amazing, but the Klingons in my headcanon just don't look like fish, okay? They just don't.
I think ultimately one of the things that defines Star Trek and therefore needs to be allowed to continue is the fact that, as we've said, it is meant to be hopeful. Things continuously happen throughout. Terrible, terrible things. And the each members will face horrible situations. You know, that they've been tortured, they've been brainwashed. Sometimes they've been brainwashed into torturing each other, okay? Data literally almost tortures Geordi to death at one point.
Yeah.
And he stabs Deanna Troi at another point. Not to give any spoilers, but Captain Picard is kind of assimilated and kills quite a few people as well. And yet blame is not put on them because of this. There is an understanding that there were extreme and extraordinary circumstances which caused this to happen. It does cause a little bit of, you know, emotional trauma as well, which is dealt with in incredibly sensitive and sensible way. And also in terms of the Prime Directive, sometimes the Prime Directive means that Picard has to kind of let certain people die or cannot interfere despite the fact that they believe that it is the right thing to do. And I do like the fact that in, you know, season one, it's very much the Prime Directive, and then season seven, it's the Prime what? But they still do mostly stick to it.
Yeah.
What's that?
The thing with the denizens of the Enterprise in every season is they always end up being a bunch of rebels who are kind of like, yeah, those orders make sense, logically, but we're not going to follow that. We're going to go with emotional reasoning, which is what they nearly always do.
They do, yeah. But I kind of do... I understand the concept of the Prime Directive, and I also understand that every now and again they sort of have to bend it for moral reasons. But there do tend to be consequences of that, and they don't shy away from the consequences of that and say this isn't necessarily the right situation. And sometimes in trying to do the right thing, it ends, you know, badly. Ultimately, the thing that continually comes out is that even though there are bad people, even though bad things happen, even though everything isn't always great, they're continuously moving forward and getting better and learning. And I just really like that because it's so hopeful. It's that even... And in Star Trek, there has been this kind of post-apocalyptic world, which for me actually is almost a little bit comforting because it basically, you know, I think if there was a sci-fi that says, and everything is great, a lot of people would go, but that just doesn't feel realistic.
Yeah.
Whereas a sci-fi that says things got bad and then they got better and they have continued to get better despite problems and despite hitting issues, that is realistic and hopeful. And that is ultimately why I really enjoy Star Trek.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody really tries. And I think all I was going to say is one of my favourite Star Trek quotes ever was one that Picard actually says to Wesley after Wesley sort of screws up some exams. There's a lot more to that episode, obviously, but we're running out of time.
Quite a lot more, yeah.
Quite a lot more. But what he says is it's possible to do everything right and still fail. And basically, there's no shame in that. There's no shame in failure. The shame would be in not trying. That's the implied part of that. And when you've got something that runs so long and captures so many people, to the point where they're willing to dress, like living their lives in cosplay, it's no longer cosplay, it's kind of like, this is every day, I live in my jumpsuit now, I am part of Starfleet. And there are people who do that, and I'm like, well, more power to you, because what you're doing is you are trying to emulate a set of values that are the absolute best you could get your hands on. Everybody tries, everybody really tries, and they fail and they get up and they try again. And yeah, that's what's so hopeful, I guess, about Star Trek.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we really do need to wrap it up there. So if anybody would like to comment, I know we have skimmed through things. We've barely touched a lot of the spin-off series, and I could have talked for another 4 hours about Star Trek, and I'm not even a really techie Star Trek nerd. Or Trekkie. I'm really not. I mean, you talk to Alan or one of our friends, Joe, who's like, he can write down to the Jefferies tubes and the blueprints of the various different ships and the different models. And I'm like, okay, you kind of left me quite a way back. I'm really more about the politics and stuff.
Yeah, not going to lie, most of the time when Geordi's talking about how they're going to fix a problem, I'm like, noises! Good.
science.
I don't hear any of it. It's just white noise, and then something happens, and that's all I'm concerned about.
So yeah,
I don't understand any of it. But if there are people out there who do, you know, more for you. Very happy for you.
Yeah. Leave us a comment if there's aspects of Star Trek you would like to hear us discuss or engage with. Get in touch. We're happy to go there.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation, and this is one that Jules and I have actually been body watching together.
Yes.
So from the distant future into the not so distant past, our recommendation for this week is a British series called Gentleman Jack. Jules, do you want to talk a little bit about Gentleman Jack?
Yeah, Gentleman Jack has been adapted from a series of diaries that were found and then hushed up because they contained scandalous stuff when people managed to crack the code. They weren't written in code originally because of the scandalous stuff, and then rediscovered and then hidden again and then rediscovered and finally translated properly. These are the diaries of Anne Lister, who was basically an 1850s landowner in Yorkshire, I think. Yorkshire.
Yeah, Yorkshire.
And yeah, she was an unconventional, very intelligent woman who was determined to live life on her terms. And because the inheritance of land and stuff was actually left to her, most unusually for the time, she had a certain amount of freedom to do so. She was a lesbian, and she was determined basically to find a woman who was willing to live with her basically as a wife. Years and years before people started running the shall we have a same-sex marriage question in the 20th century. And it, yes. How she does it is fascinating. She is actually not a fantastically nice person. She's got some great bits. I love her linguistic skill. I love her intelligence. I even kind of love the fact that she doesn't suffer fools gladly, because I can identify with that so easily. And she's adventurous and strong and scared of very little. And the sort of bravery it takes to be yourself to that level is really admirable. She's also massively classist, quite derogatory of anyone who can't meet her as an intellectually equal, and just doesn't see other people having emotional problems unless that they directly affect her. So, you know, yeah. She has this hubris and this purblindness, but it just makes her more interesting, okay?
She is a very interesting character. I will say, because I'm actually a little bit further on in the series than you are, Jules,
yeah.
That as the time goes on, she does actually display a greater level of kindness as well. So for anyone who's a little bit put off because she seems to be kind of a bit cruel, you will actually discover there is a softness about her, and there is a compassion, and she isn't actually always very, very unpleasant, and that actually she isn't just a bit of a womanizer either. She genuinely
can get hurt, and she's putting on a brave face sometimes. And she's a very engaging character, and it is actually a very interesting series, not least because, as Jules said, it's based on truth and on the diaries of a real person. So definitely worth watching. You can find it on BBC iPlayer for those Brits who are listening. Not sure what you do if you're not in Britain to anyone else. To any of our listeners outside of that, but I'm sure you'll be able to get hold of it, of DVDs, and you'll be able to get hold of it in future months. So, Gentleman Jack, one to put down for future viewing. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.